fence. We're asking for 12 years and a dog musher for most of them. Tomorrow he'll start his racing season outside in Houghton, Michigan. I wondered why make the long trip rather than stay in Alaska for racing.
You can start earlier outside. The main race circuit outside is in the during the month of January and the first part of February, where our major races start here the middle of February and go into March and even the beginning of April. Has developed a really top-notch racing circuit in the Midwest, the northern Midwest, and even, well, all over the northern United States. And it's actually financially a good idea to go out. If you think you've got a competitive team, you can make good money going out. So I wouldn't say money's the major consideration. I just like to get into the competition a little earlier, and when you get done racing outside, you have a pretty fair idea of how you're going to stack up here in the major races in the spring.
After the Houghton race this weekend, he and his handler will be going to Ashland, Wisconsin, Bemidji and Ely, Minnesota, Saranac Lake, New York, and then a couple of races in Canada before heading back up to Alaska. It's his third time out on the circuit. The first year was just to survey the scene and buy and sell a few dogs. But last year he raced and came in the money every time. Of the 60 dogs Brunk keeps in his yard near Fairbanks, 24 are making the trip with him, though in most races he'll run 14. The others are spares.
Depending on the conditions, certain dogs do better on, you know, certain tracks, and you try to pick the best team you can put together for that weekend.
In selecting those dogs, I wondered what he looked for.
I'm looking for speed, basically, and to get speed out of a dog, you have to, what we call, they have to have the head. There's a lot of dogs that maybe are capable of running fast, but they don't want to do it, you know. And what I look for, personally, is a dog that wants to run, and a lot of times a dog with a good head, a desire to run, will compensate for certain physical shortcomings he may have. He may not have as good a speed, say, as what we call a lazy dog, but he can, he'll give you everything he's got, and thus he ends up being a better dog. So it's basically the attitude in a dog that I look for, and then they have to have the physical characteristics to go with that good head. And the other thing is a toughness, the type of racing that you end up doing in the end of the season, say, that, well, let's take the North American, is two 20-mile heats and a 30-mile heat, 3 days of racing. That requires a really tough animal.
It requires a really tough musher, too.
I think probably anybody that has managed to get fairly competitive in dogs has really looked at himself very closely, too. I think dogs, they can either bring out your worst or your best, and I think to be competitive, some of your good parts have to come out. You have to be able to really tune into your dogs and into yourself, because if you wake up in the morning and you're going to have a bad day, chances are your dogs will have a bad day. They pretty much reflect your moods.
Before Dick Brunk left town for the trip down the highway, I asked him what he thought his chances were for this racing season. Evidently, his mood was good.
I'm really excited. It's the best team I've had. You know, who knows? Somebody else might have a better one. I'm sure George Atla would be somebody to consider as having a better team, but, you know, we might be able to compete with him.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
There's a feeling among a lot of people that subsistence priority really ought to be legislated, and that there is a need for the legislature to make a statement recognizing that subsistence played an important part in people's livelihood in Alaska. And so the result of that was the 1978 law that was passed and by the legislature and stated as a statewide priority that subsistence use would have priority for all fish and game resources. And it also set up within that a subsistence section within the Department of Fish and Game that was authorized to conduct studies and advise the board on subsistence matters.
The Act defines subsistence sources, uses the following criteria. 1, customary and direct dependence upon the resource as the mainstay of one's livelihood. 2, local residency. And 3, availability of alternative resources. One thing that's interesting to me about this is that it avoids the issue of a racial definition of subsistence.
Yeah, that's right. I think the state, the legislature, was clear in that they did not prescribe any racial distinction in subsistence. And we don't prescribe any urban versus rural necessarily distinction, poor versus wealthy or anything, until you get down to specific cases. And the idea was to try and allow subsistence to be regulated using existing mechanisms that the boards have available to them. And then, as the need exists, to begin to restrict, say, in the case of moose in a particular area, if the existing bag limits and seasons and so forth are taking care of subsistence needs as well as sport hunting needs, then the board will stick with those limits and those regulations.
But how does one determine what is a subsistence need and what is a sport hunting kind of situation?
Well, the framework that the law set up begins without making that distinction. It basically says, as long as the resource can handle, say, moose hunting for a particular area, then both would be allowed and subject to just the existing regulations. If you get down to the point where you have to start restricting more, say the moose population is low enough around a certain village or in a certain area, where more restriction is needed because of biological constraints, then the framework is set up to start adjusting the seasons, the bag limits, the access, so that it may be more convenient for certain users versus other users to take advantage of the resource.
Meaning, presumably, that a person living in an area has more ready access. That relates to the local residency requirement of the Act, and it's already created a problem. Last spring, the Board of Game set up a second November season for moose in the Minto Flats area west of Fairbanks, with a provision that only residents of the Minto area could hunt. As anticipated, there was flack from sportspeople. The Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association filed suit, and the case is still pending. There's a question regarding the constitutionality of a residence-only hunt. Then there's the third facet of the criteria for subsistence, availability of alternative resources. Again, just what that is intended to mean is hard to pin down. Available in local stores, through the mail, off the land, and so forth. Caulfield acknowledges the broadness of the criterion and suggests that, like the other two criteria, it must be evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
If subsistence resources, or the resources in general, get down to the point where biologically they can sustain only a very limited harvest, and subsistence, again, the priority, has to be addressed, then you could look at a specific community and say, what alternatives are available to this community? We're not looking at individuals generally in this case. We're looking at communities and at regions to see what alternatives are available. Are there other wildlife resources available? Are fish more available? Could people take more fish, for example, not hurting the population there, and make up for what they might have lost, say, in caribou not coming through the village this year?
Make up in what sense? A nutritional sense or a psychological sense?
Well, probably both. But again, this is the type of thing where the subsistence section has to go in and look at the specific case and make some recommendations to the board, which ultimately has to decide.
The board receives input from local advisory councils who comment on proposals and submit their own. There was a recent case in the village of Buckland on the Seward Peninsula regarding a resource shortage. The matter was brought to the attention of the Department of Fish and Game and its recently established subsistence section.
They had problems getting beluga, and they take up to 70% of their subsistence needs from marine mammals. And they had a poor beluga harvest. They also had a poor seal harvest. And coupled with that, they had a loss of their generator capacity, which forced with the freezers shut down, they lost about 20% of their meat. And they made a petition to come up with a proposal to harvest 210 caribou from the Western Arctic herd, which, of course, is slowly rebuilding now after a low point a few years ago. And in the Buckland situation, the local village submitted a petition to the board requesting a special hunt of 210 caribou. The Kotzebue Advisory Board also approved that and agreed with it and felt that it was a good proposal. And they submitted this to the board, and the board, of course, asked the game biologists from that area dealing with the Western Arctic herd whether that was the proposal was within bounds as far as they were concerned. They also asked the subsistence section resource specialist in that area to go into the community, spend time, find out what the needs of the users in that area were, and report to the board.
The result? A special hunt was permitted for Buckland. But caribou are regulated by the state. Other types of fish and game and other physical locations are not so clear regarding state or federal jurisdiction. Subsistence management sections of both H.R. 39 and S.9 use the language of the state's 1978 Act to define subsistence. But if a Lands Act passes that incorporates that language, that alone couldn't clear up the ongoing and potential conflicts.
The character of the wildlife management will depend in large part on what Congress decides, but the department's policy is that the state should manage the fish and wildlife resources. The subsistence section is clearly going to have to look at those types of issues when they're dealing with specific resource needs in any given area. In the Yukon Flats, the Yukon Flats National Monument now clearly affects many of the people in Fort Yukon and other villages. And already, we're seeing some impacts there. And I think we're going to have to work closely with federal managers, too, in managing the resources there and making sure that subsistence needs are met.
That's a process that's just beginning. There'll be much more staking out of the turf for the federal and state interests and subsistence, recreational, and commercial harvesters of fish and game as the 1978 Alaskan Subsistence Law is implemented. You've been listening to Rick Caulfield, Resource Specialist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Fairbanks, describe some of that Act's provisions. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
The people at home used to go out, for the winter trapping in September, and they'd be gone for, till Christmas, then they'd come in for Christmas, maybe spent 2 weeks or a month with their families, and then go back again.
The speaker is Pauline Carlo. Home is Nulato, an Athabascan Indian village on the Yukon River. The time is the early 1940s, when the way of life was a mixture of a nomadic, subsistence-based, seasonal lifestyle and living in the village. The families that did leave the log cabins in town for winter camp had to get going well before the freeze-up.
By boat, they take the dogs and their sled and the family, their winter supply of food for the themselves and also the dogs. So that in itself was a big, big move,
What kinds of things did people want to get together before winter hit?
You had to get your fish. You have to get your dried fish for yourself and for your dogs. You had to put up your berries. And if you got any ducks in the fall, you had to put that away. You didn't have no refrigerators then, and you had to salt your ducks and geese down in barrels or else dry them and smoke them. Mm-hmm. And then when you get ready to cook the dried geese and ducks, you had to soak it overnight to get it soft.
When they were salted, were the feathers still on?
Oh, no. When you salt them in barrels, you have to take the feathers, clean them,
uh-huh,
and clean the insides, and split them, and then just, salt it down like that.
Mm-hmm.
The dried, you have to do the same. But then later in the fall, if your ducks and geese are caught after it's getting cold, then all you do is clean the insides, and you don't have to pluck them then. You just freeze it that way.
Uh-huh.
And it stayed good that way.
Is it hard to get the feathers off?
No, You just thaw it overnight, yeah, in the house and then pluck it, and it's just like fresh.
The village of Nulato, which had been established by the Russians in the mid-1800s, had 100 years after its founding grown into a hub of activity. A Catholic mission and school brought not only a new religion, but celebrations as well, religious and secular. Christmas and New Year's were among them. These were times that everyone looked forward to, the people coming in from outlying camps and the village folks as well, including Pauline Carlo's family.
That's another thing we used to look forward to when the people come in to town. They'd stop with the different people in town that are staying in town, and we always used to have people stopping with us, and it was really great. People would have their own caribou mattresses, and they'd all sleep on the floor, and we used to like that.
Uh-huh. They come in by dog team?
Uh-huh, yes. Then some people had their families in town build fire in their houses overnight so that it'll be nice and warm when they come in,
But they used to come in really at a certain day, pretty much.
Some people would come ahead and say, well, your so-and-so is coming tomorrow, and they want you to, you know, get the fire started in their house so it'll be warm by tomorrow.
And then what kinds of celebrations would happen during Christmas time?
Well, the mission would always have a Christmas tree, and then the kids that stayed in town would give a play, which was great, too. And, like, the Christmas presents we made ourselves during our home class, you know, at the mission. It wasn't much, maybe a pair of socks, but the thing was that it was made by us, you know, which meant a lot.
Although there was no community Christmas potlatch, there were dances in the community hall, lots of them.
Modern dances we had, pretty much so like they sometimes would go on for over a week every night, you know, like from Christmas till after New Year's. We'd have dance every night.
Like with fiddle music?
Uh-huh. Guitars and mandolin and fiddle.
Did people square dance?
Oh, yes. They tried that a couple of years ago down there, but nobody, it just couldn't, they couldn't even follow. The older people tried, but the young ones screwed up.
Christmas dances in Nulato these days still have mandolin and fiddle music, but it's along with the rock and roll. You've been listening to Pauline Carlo, author of Nulato, An Indian Life on the Yukon. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Jimmy, I just came back from a lovely trip along the Milky Way. I stopped up at the North Pole to spend the holiday. I called on old dear Santa Claus to see what I could see. He took me to his workshop and told his plans to me. Now Santa is a busy man. He has no time to play. He's got millions of stockings to fill on Christmas Day. You better write your letter now and mail it right away, because he's getting ready his reindeers and his sleigh.
Is this really Santa Claus's house?
Why, it sure is.
How would somebody know it was Santa's house?
Well, I think it would only take about one or two quick looks, and I think that would, you would have to say it is Santa Claus' house.
Well, does Santa live here?
Oh, he sure does.
Well, who might that be?
Well, I'm his chief helper. He's pretty hard to get along, to get in touch with personally.
As his helper, what is your role in relationship to Santa?
Well, I kind of have to double for him several times. When he's not able to go around, I have to put his costume on and take his place. Because he's a very, very busy man. You know that there's the millions and millions and millions of children that he has to serve. He has a pretty hard time, so I help him along and have for many, many years.
How many years have you been helping Santa out this way?
Better than 30 years.
How did you get started? I mean, how did you first meet Santa and get into this business?
Well, I had a small store in Washington, and one Christmas Eve, I heard him knock on the back door, and I went, and there he was, and he said, you know, I'm in trouble. I need some help. They had busted one of the runners on the sled, and so he said, will you do my work for me here in this area? And I said, I sure will. So I went ahead and finished his job in the small town. And ever since then, I've been doing some of his work for him.
The man who's taken on so much of Santa's load, answering thousands of letters from kids around the world, is Con Miller of North Pole. North Pole, Alaska, that is. I always thought North Pole was actually supposed to be at the North Pole.
Right in the middle of the Arctic Ocean? Oh, that would be pretty hard, especially when it might melt someday, and then Santa's house would be dropping right down to the middle of the ocean. That wouldn't work, would it?
North Pole, Alaska, and Santa Claus House, the year-round dispensary of Christmas cheer, muzak, and knickknacks, is almost too much to take in. The building itself is visible from the highway leading south of Fairbanks, and according to Miller, much smaller than Santa's real workshop, and it's decorated outside with paintings showing a giant red-nosed Santa, elves, reindeer, a snowman, an igloo with parka-clad white-faced Eskimos, and almost anything else that kind of fits. But there was a less fantastic predecessor.
Well, I actually had a trading company in Fairbanks, and I dealt a great deal with the natives and road construction people, road camps. Came Christmas, Christmas 1950, and I had my Santa Claus suit, so I went to the Canadian border and with my car loaded with gifts for the youngsters, and it took me 3 days. I stopped at every village and house along the way. Santa paid a visit to him. At first, I named my trading company the North Pole Trading Post, or that's what I was going to call it. And a load of youngsters came along one day while I was working on my building in between seasons, and they spotted me, and of course they knew Santa in costume and out of costume. And one of the little youngsters said, "What are you doing, Santa? Building a new house?" And so that's how Santa Claus House got its name.
Santa Claus House is here all year round, not just Christmas time. That seems a little strange.
Oh, no, not at all. Not with now that we have made North Pole the city of North Pole. It is the tourists like to drop by and see where Santa Claus really lives. Although they can't see him, they like to see where he lives.
Does Santa ever check in with you to see how things are going as his representative?
Oh, yes. The old rascal's always checking, make sure that there's no mistakes.
Making mistakes isn't something Miller's likely to worry about after all these years and all those convinced kids, including, for a time, his own.
For the first 2 or 3 years, there was a bit of confusion. But they soon accepted the fact that it was the uniform, not what was in it.
And does Santa, or rather Santa's double, Con Miller, have a message to pass on to folks this Christmas? Yes, he does. The first concern, sliding down those chimneys. He says it gets harder as the night goes on.
I make it all right in the first few thousand, but they have so much cookies and so much that, you know, I got stuck in the chimney. And I had one terrible time. I almost got off schedule. I wish they'd just cut the portions in half and occasionally leave something that'll warm me up rather than that would put more calories in Santa. One thing that we have to pass on, and that is to wish each and every person and child a very, very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Santa is going to try to bring all the gifts that he possibly can. If the youngsters don't get what they ask for, it's because there's just so many children we don't have enough to go around. But again, I want to wish everybody a very, very Merry Christmas. And I'm on my way.
You better watch out. Yeah.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.